Philosophers in
space, 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 space.
I don't pretend to understand Brannigan's Law. I merely enforce it.
Listen, I'm not the nicest guy in the universe, because I'm the smartest, and being nice is something stupid people do to hedge their bets.
So, do you know what I'm gonna do before I do it?
Yes.
What if I do something different?
Then I don't know that.
Cool, cool.
I wish I read that book by that wheelchair guy.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 50. Wow, that's a major milestone. Well, up here in space, I don't know, it all blends together. But I guess we've floated around the Earth, which floated around the sun for around a year. Sounds good.
How's it going? Numbers mean nothing in space.
Yeah, exactly. And who knows what timeline we're in by now. And, you know, relativity, you got to factor that in.
Mm-hmm,
but 50 episodes, I think numbers aren't relative. I think numbers, we pretty much just counted to 50. So that's should be straightforward.
Or did we?
Yeah, we actually recorded this one first as a prank. So,
Yeah. No, just kidding. The whole thing's been a call forward, basically. Doing good. I got my T.S. Eliot. I got my guidebook to interpreting T.S. Eliot. I've got my handbook to the guidebook to interpreting T.S. Eliot.
Nice. I've got my Aaron Rabbi, so
right.
That's all I need.
Got a big book of every reference ever made by anyone ever.
Yeah.
That's going to be important here.
This really was a good one for you to have picked in terms of, you know, the Rick and Morty episode goes really well with this one, I think. I mean, the thing that I mainly care about philosophically about, you know, regarding this is different, but I think we can all be happy and all incorporate it all in. So the last one, of course, was mainly an exposition zone slash a love fest for how good that Rick and Morty was. And so this
and you
time,
picked the episode, by the way. You picked everything this time around. This
oh,
was
did
all
I?
You.
I thought oh, yeah. Okay, sorry.
And I think you made very great choices here.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll
no,
take
we're,
it.
We're leaving all of that in.
I have no memory, so no.
That's okay.
Okay,
I blame
awesome.
Your spawn.
Yeah, so I'm a genius, and in exchange for doing that massive love fest last week, we're mainly sticking to the philosophy this week, of course. So why don't you tell us about this reading. It was honestly it was a little dense, a little difficult. I think you'll do a better job of trying to break that down than I would, so take it away.
Yeah, I mean, I won't claim to say that I understand even the majority of what T.S. Eliot is saying at any given moment, and I think that's partly by his own design.
Yeah.
which is partly about what this paper is about, because it is about referencing and tradition. The paper is called Tradition and the Individual Talent. It's an essay that you can, you know, we'll put it in the show notes, obviously. And it's a very dense little three-section discussion of the place of the poet in the arc of artistic endeavor, and it has, you were particularly interested in this one really famous pull quote that is fits within this fascinating, in my opinion, sort of view of the question of can art improve in aesthetics and that sort of thing.
A shame he didn't write more about it. I forget if I mentioned this last week, but he just said, because, you know, art never improves. And then he never explained it. And he stated, like, everyone knows that, right? And it's like, oh, that's an interesting, I kind of want to talk about that, but we'll get to it.
Yeah. I mean, it is a short quote, so I figured I can read the quote directly.
Oh, sure.
And then maybe we could talk some about what I think he means, my interpretation of T.S. Eliot's.
Okay, that's going to make me want to launch into my stuff, so I didn't know if you wanted to do, you know, your angle first, or you want to cover that first?
Either way.
Okay.
You know, I think, let me just read the quote for starters for people, because I think it's a short, valuable little quote, and it sets up a lot of stuff. So he says, he, the artist, because of course the poet is a male,
yeah.
He must
and
be
it was
quite
written, what, like 1919 or some crap?
It's, right.
Yeah.
Right. He must be quite aware of the obvious fact that art never improves, but that the material of art is never quite the same. He must be aware that the mind of Europe, the mind of his own country, a mind which he learns in time to be much more important than his own private mind, is a mind which changes, and that this change is a development which abandons nothing en route, which does not superannuate either Shakespeare or Homer or the rock drawings of the Magdalene draughtsman, that this development, refinement perhaps, complication certainly, is not from the point of view of the artist any improvement. So I think that's a great, fun little paragraph to pick apart there.
Yeah, there's so much. There's going to be like what he might have been saying and what, you know, we might want to say. There's a lot of directions to go down. Mm-hmm. I think it's also quaint how I'm sure a lot of this view is quaint. Like I, because from my perspective, and this probably relates more to what you were going to talk about, I feel like you could create perfectly good art. I mean, it might be more difficult, but you could create good art without having any access to prior art in some cases, you know, like, I mean, I guess you're going to need, it's going to be pretty impossible to go completely from a blank slate, but you don't need a comprehensive encyclopedic knowledge of, you know, all of this history of poetry and stuff to write a poem. Like, I feel like you could start from a position of wanting to express something and find a way to express it and not have to, like, reference all this other stuff.
Yeah, and he actually points to that objection, right? He mentions that specific objection. Yeah, he says, here's the quote, I am alive to the usual objection to what is clearly part of my program for the meter of poetry specifically. The objection is that the doctrine requires a ridiculous amount of erudition or pedantry, a claim which can be rejected by appeal to the lives of poets in any pantheon. It will even be so affirmed that much learning deadens or perverts poetic sensibility. So I think he's keenly aware of the pushback of his. He's going to basically say poets need to be steeped in tradition. And one pushback there is, but you can obviously do good art without having to necessarily appeal to a bunch of specific, you know, canonical cultural references. Mm-hmm. Right. So I totally think that your intuition is a good one. And I think there's a lot of places where we should push back on him here. But I do want to, like, steel man his position a little bit for what I think he's arguing for, even though I think I actually have the opposite intuition of him in this case as well, for maybe slightly different reasons than you do. One other table setting thing that I think I want to put here before we jump into this, though, is all of this is predicated on the assumption that there's better and worse art.
Right.
In some sense.
So that's
right?
That's a couple episodes that we could do.
Right. And I want to say there's a section of the population listening to this episode whose constant critiques are going to be some form of, yeah, but no art is better than other art, and some version of that. And, like, I think that's a good, interesting question, but it is separate from this question.
I think it's pretty entwined with the questions I wanted to ask, so we'll see. Okay. We can start with where you're going first, though.
Okay. I guess what I at least want to say is, yes, this is based on the assumption, and I think it is a defensible assumption to say that, or a defensible premise to say that some art is objectively better than other art. Not necessarily that you can always prove which art is better or worse.
I kind of feel like we probably need to talk about that, though. Were you trying to skirt by that?
Well, if you really want to dive into that here, then we can.
Well, I want to know if objectively is right. I would love to believe that objectively some art is better than others. I frequently, you know, like, I love to make fun of stuff that I don't like just because it's funny and for comedic value. Mm-hmm. And you would think that would be on the assumption that it's bad. But I don't know if objectively is right. I mean, is it objective or is it enough? Is it subjective, but in a kind of a structured way, you know, like, our objectively good art is not going to do, you know, I was going to curse, but I forgot. This is before After Dark. So we'll, you know, keep it clean. It's not going to do diddly squat for, you know, a club of chimpanzees. But, you know, some of my banana related humor that might do nothing at the club that I keep trying to make my banana bits work and they just don't work, that might kill in front of the chimpanzee crowd. And you might say, okay, well, you know, different species. But I mean, I only bring it up because is it objective or is it based on where your mind is situated, where different people's minds are situated? And is it subjective, but in a way we can enough, like certain people can agree on that does certain things. You know, like what would you see as the distinction between
objectivity? Yeah, it gets really tricky. My take at this point is there are objective comparisons to be made, though ultimate all things considered judgments are not going to be objective in this kind of way.
This might sound really stupid, but can you just define what you mean by objective? Because if I was, maybe I was making a bad move by taking it out of our species. Is it like, oh, something that no matter how many humans disagree on, you'd still, there in some greater sense, it's correct or something like that? Is that the definition you would use?
Yeah, like the difference between, like we would say the greater quality, some would call it the greater perfection of the Mona Lisa as compared to, you know, the stuff that I would try to draw if I tried to paint something like that.
Yeah, but I still don't think it could be objective. I think that because when we talk about objective, like, you know, I'm used to this debate in the context of, you know, some of the religious debates I have where it's like, oh, there are objective moral values. And those are usually defined as values that even if every single person on the planet was like, nah, murder is great, it would still objectively be wrong. And I actually, I don't think you could possibly say that, that the same would be true for art. Like if everybody on Earth was like, the Mona Lisa is terrible, we all like just throw up, we start vomiting the second we see it. We hate it. It's all, the entire planet feels that way. Yeah. I don't think there's any way, like how, where would you even begin in making an argument like, oh no, it's actually good by some other standard we can't access.
I tend to be on your side on the intuitions here, right? You know that I'm a moral realist. I believe that there are those objective moral truths. And I think that aesthetics is a harder case to make than the moral realist case because there's a really good way that one of the papers that I teach on describes this, where what they say is there are specific features that you can point to when saying X piece of art is better than Y piece of art at this certain thing or that certain thing. Like this play is more economical in its use of time than this other play. So if you like a play that, you know, moves along.
Ah, but you just did it there. You said, so if you like,
let me finish what I'm saying. Let me finish what I'm saying. Right. The problem is, right, for, you know, even if there are those objective features that you can point to, right, this book is long and turgid or something, right, it just goes on forever. There's no arrangement of those features that can guarantee necessarily an objective higher quality of art. So in that sense, like I said, the all of the above, the all things considered judgment is going to fundamentally be subjective because, like you said, it's going to depend on which of those metrics you value more or less. And there is no, unlike with ethics, there's no fact of the matter about which things you should value more or less. So that's where I ultimately, I think, come down on that. That being said, I do
I wonder if, and apologies, but I wonder if that argument you just made, I think, I'm going to come at you a little bit. I don't even know if that touches the question of objectivity versus subjectivity. Like, I think that that strikes me, what you just said there strikes me as, is there a, like, I wouldn't have been surprised if the question you were trying to answer is there like a formula for making art that people will like? You
know, exactly.
Because you're talking about, oh, can you take this characteristic, you know, rhyming, people love that, let's do, put that in, add in a little, economical use of time, as you said, add in some this and that, oh, people like this over here, voila, and then you're saying, well, that still could be a total piece of garbage to people. But that's still, to me, that doesn't touch on objectivity, that just means, that speaks to me to, more about, like, art itself, like the artistic quality of... This is not something that you can write down a list of steps for and then, bam, you've made good art if you've ticked all the boxes. Like, but but that still is all within the framework of if tomorrow the whole earth decided they hate rhyming, then you can't just argue that rhyming is objectively good and they're all wrong. You know, like, can you?
A little bit I can, right? Okay. I can say, for example, rhyming is good because it forces you to be more thoughtful about your word choice because it forces, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? It the structure forces you to
be. But I would come back at you and I would say, oh no, but we all of a sudden, the whole planet is fans of haikus. We don't care about rhyming. We care about how many syllables there are. And that forces you to think about the words that you're using. mm-hmm. just as much, if not more, than your little rhyming thing you got going.
Sure, it certainly could. I think other ways in which you would find that there could be, you could argue for a kind of objective value would be, you know, does this art innovate in some way in its ability to convey certain things? So, you know, like part of my perspective on what is better or worse art ties in with the art's ability to convey truth or experience or shared right. understanding between human beings. And I think some art conveys better than others. And I'm not saying that should be the only metric that anyone uses, but it is another metric by which I think,
you know, and I think I agree with that. And I also think it's also not objective. I just hope I've made that point. Like, I actually really feel strong, even stronger than I did going into this. It's not objective. It's still subjective. But anyway, I think
my last pushback would be.
Sure. Go ahead.
On a, you know, like on a fine grained level, you know, when you get down into this problem, I agree with you. And at the same time, in my mind, there is an absolute certainty that this episode of Rick and Morty is objectively better than Battlefield Earth. Like, there is
Here's the thing. You know, I have this. I love this that we're having this discussion because I've thought, again, so much in the context of religious debates, I think it applies here because this is the same move, the exact same move. What you just did is, who's the William Lane Craig? You just pulled a Lillian Lane Craig, but for this. Oh, this is fantastic. This is already my favorite episode. Because he'll do the same thing. All right, here's my proof. Because people ask him, and I would ask him if I ever debate him, although he'd school me because he's a debate master. I'm not being facetious. He's really good at seeming
it's
like
fine.
He's,
I'll school you, too. You ahead.
Same thing. You could totally school me. But I would say, hey, how do you know their objective moral values or objective artistic, you know, good values, whatever? And you would say, well, we all look at rape, for example. We all just immediately know that it's wrong. And it's like it's the same move of we all know that Rick and Morty is better than Battlefield Earth.
Yeah. So this gets into the question of intuitions and their role within all of philosophy, actually. I was having this conversation with, again, not William Lane Craig, an actual really good philosopher, who was basically biting the bullet with me and saying, look, intuitions play a fundamental role in especially moral reasoning.
And I think that's why it can be flawed.
Go ahead. I think you have to agree with me that any theory that comes to the conclusion that the Nazis throwing babies into ovens is objectively immoral. I think that's a reductio ad absurdum to deny that.
I believe there are objective moral values, but not objective artistic.
And that's fine. And then, like, I just want to, what I'm saying is just because theists also make a version of the move that I just made,
right?
You should understand that also really good ethicists and really good philosophers also make a similar move that I just made, which is, look, we have these two really serious competing intuitions. And thinking you can just do away with either one of them by saying, it's obviously just subjective, is not understanding the seriousness of the challenge.
Okay, right? But here's where I – good point. And I did want to go back to what you were saying and agree with part of it till we got a little sidetracked by me accusing you of being William Lane Craig, which I don't –
It's fine. I smacked you down like a debate master, and we can move on now.
Which I don't regret. No, but here's the thing. The opposite of objective is not arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
So just because it's not objective does not mean it's random. You know, like it's still subjective in the sense, and maybe it could be a definitional thing. Maybe it merely means we're slightly disagreeing on the definition of objective versus subjective. I think art is entirely determined by the reactions of the people who are viewing the art. Whereas morality, I do not think is the same way. I think if a bunch of people get brainwashed into wanting to hurt themselves or something, yes, they may think it's okay, but in the terms of human suffering and thriving as a whole, like you can build a coherent moral system that would account for why that's still wrong despite people disagreeing, which I don't think you can do the same way in art. But it doesn't mean it's random. It still means that we are people who, humans are, for the most part, very similar in many ways. And there are, I remember back what I was going to say. I totally agreed with you with, and I was going to say, if I'm understanding T.S. Eliot correctly, I think he has some good points in this essay, some really good points along these lines. when he talks about the fact, and I may be, apologies, I may be injecting some of my thinking into this too. I don't, it's such a dense read that it's hard to know. You know, it's like reading tea leaves or something. Like, I don't know how much is me putting myself into this. But when he talks about the fact that one road people went down, maybe, or poets that he doesn't like go down, is like trying to find new experiences or new emotions and have that be the way that you're doing unique and new art. And he's like, no. The emotions, the feelings, the reality, which I think is kind of touches on what you said a minute ago, that's consistent. Like, humans, for the most part, we know what the experiences are. You know, we know love, we know death, we know hatred, we know anger, all the stuff that is going to affect us emotionally. We know all that. We agree on all that. You don't need to invent a new emotion where it's like, oh, it's the slight jealousy, but with a tinge of something, like you're, you know, trying to have some unique thing. Mm-hmm. We know that. It's that you want to, it's the balance of trying to express it in a way that makes people feel it. So, you know, I just said, me saying here, I'm angry, that's not a good way of emoting anger. You know, I do this a lot of times when we critique these bad movies, movies where the dialogue just says it, you know, just says what it is. And that's why I don't like, for example, Les Mis. I can't, all the lyrics are just, I'm sad, it's the worst, and my baby died or something, you know, like I can't. The music is beautiful.
I'm not going to argue with you on Les Mis.
Yeah,
at all.
The music's beautiful, but I can't get behind the lyrics. They're just too, just says it, you know? Side note, that still is my subjective view. So, like, I'm not saying that's objectively better. But anyway, the point is doing that, but also doing it in a way that is unique, because I totally agree with you that finding a way to say something in a way that hasn't quite been said, I think there's something about that humans really love. You know, if we see the same boring shtick comedy that from like the 50s, if someone were to try to do that now, you know, like we'd be like, this is like grating. We would be insulted by it. It would be so boring.
Yeah, absolutely. And I you're getting background to his central conceit, which I think is really important. But I want to say just one, I want to put a little button on sort of my side of the take on whether there can be objectively better and worse art. I'm sorry.
I'll just put in here, if you hear a slight noise, it is the ghost of Robert Marley. Or is it? I always know because I know the Muppets version. I get confused.
Yeah, Robert Marley.
They added a Marley. Okay, so Robert's the real Marley.
Well, there's Jacob. No, Jacob Marley's the real one.
Jacob Marley. Yeah, Jacob's the real Marley. That's why I was. Okay.
Yeah.
So Jacob Marley is rattling those chains in Aaron's apartment. So apologies for that. You might hear them here and there.
I want to put a button on agreeing with what you are saying, but the difference between ethics and aesthetics, in that, like, there can be, you know, you could have a whole universe of beings who are wrong about ethics in a way that they couldn't all be wrong about aesthetics, right? I think that that's the difference in the objective subjective that I agree with you about here. So, like, I think of, for example, if not Battlefield Earth, then Vogon Poetry or something from Hitchhikers, right? If there were a species out there that really, really, really enjoyed Battlefield Earth, right?
Yeah.
I don't think there
you
would be a
argue
way
in, with them.
Right. There's not a way in which you can really say they're doing something
I feel
wrong.
Like I'm living on that planet as regards comic book movies. There's nothing I can say to you people. It doesn't.
Oh my God. You got to save that for After Dark. We're going to start getting emails again.
You're going to get hate mail. I'm mainly joking. There's some good ones. I'm mainly joking.
It's for anyone who's upset, I want you to know that I'm going to make him do Infinity Wars really soon because I've got a really good hook for it now. So you will
not
be
not as a NASA. You mean as an actual episode?
Oh no, as a real episode. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right, I'll do it.
Yeah. Oh, you will do it. All right. So let's get to the T.S. Eliot before we run out. It's all the time and have to just do a part three here.
We're doing a part three.
Well, yeah, we are doing part three. But I want to at least start to get into this, right? Because what he's getting at is the thing that you were just saying about there being sort of like better art in the sense of getting more complex, because what he's pushing back on is the idea that the new art, because it can be more complex, is somehow, I think, supersedes or removes the need to know the old art. And I think that this is a valuable kind of critique of the way that art actually works. And I want to come back to Rick and Morty on this, right? The reason that Rick and Morty can do what it does is not just that the show has built up three seasons of really tight referential structure, but that it's drawing on not just Back to the Future, but a whole world of references that have accrued over the course of human culture. And so, like, each story can draw on layers and layers of references. And that gives the art the ability to convey more information more quickly. And I think T.S. Eliot agrees that that is, in a sense, a kind of good. But what he wants to emphasize is you only get there by standing on the shoulders of giants, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make the prior stuff bad. It does change the relationship we have to the prior stuff, but it doesn't necessarily make it sort of totally obsolete, in a sense.
I have a lot of thoughts, and okay. I may get a bit meta here. Not, maybe not meta, but like, you know, like galaxy brain, like just dropped ripped a bong hit. You know, because I'm thinking if in a weird way you could relate this to like the second law of thermodynamics or whatever. I mean, is there the supernova of references that happen, like the longer time goes, so as entropy increases, or is it increases,
we're gonna be messing, making a lot of scientists very angry while trying
it is I'm not claiming to be a scientist, but conceptually, does that same thing happen where and especially it's I've been thinking about this a lot lately with how our media environment is, you know, with how it's so interesting, it's split off in 80,000 million different directions. And to kind of, I think this actually goes along maybe with what T.S. Eliot or what you were saying, he was saying. Another reason it's not better art just because it has more references is because that's all in the eye of the beholder. You know, like if we get to a point, let's say we get to a point in internet culture and technology and how our you know, media is consumed, that it's so fractured that you can never really be sure who has seen what. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're not, back in the day, everyone has seen, you know, Thor's cave painting. They've all seen that one cave painting. And so you're like, oh, I know, I'm going to do a little painting, but it's slight. I'm going to change it slightly here. And then everyone's going to get the joke. They'll be like, oh, yeah, he put the, you know, the boar is over here instead of over here. That's what an amazing reference.
So innovative.
And, yeah. Everybody knows what it is. But like once fast forward even to now, or like, you know, 10 years from now, when there are so many smaller sources of media, smaller like channels of internet, comic, you know, we talked the other day, was that on this show or another show? I can't remember, but kids are like, they don't even know what TV is. They just watch YouTube now. Like when you're working in a media environment in which you have no idea what your audience has even seen. You know, it's kind of dystopian now that I think about it. Like, what if 50 years from now, you can't even reference the greatest works in human history because you're not sure if like that it'll make sense? You know, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, no, I'm 100. I was having all of these same thoughts as I was prepping for this, like almost verbatim, a lot of the things you're saying. Like, we're going to have to do a part three here because
haven't even touched on what I wanted to talk about. So that's fine. Okay. We'll do a part three.
Because I also want to talk about the nature of references and art as a key tentpole in society and in community formation, because I'm really big on community organizing. And I think what you're saying, this potential collapse of community organization through the collapse of shared references is...
Well, hold on. Let me say not just collapse, but maybe just it's like dialing in. What do you call it? When it's like siloing, like all these bazillion different
balkanizing.
Silos. Balkanizing. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Like there could be this kind of Tower of Babel 2.0 that comes about as a result of the proliferation of cultural references. And I think that may be part of the problem that we're already seeing right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's because T.S. Eliot isn't wrong that, like, yes, you can go too far with your obsession with historical and cultural references, but really what we mean by culture and society is not oftentimes not so much, I think, shared laws, but shared norms and references, but really just references. Like there's an important way in which a reference allows you and I to bridge the gap between us that is really essential. And I think we need to dig into that further.
I have so much I want to say. And and a little teaser for next week's episode, because I want to talk about this question of can art improve? It's it's related. Like, we're touching on it here and there. And I also, I actually also wanted to talk about answering the question of whether or not art, you could say art is better than some other art, which we, I'm glad we kind of did that today. But it's funny how we had, you and I had different angles of where we wanted to go, but they converge a lot of places. So it'll be fun to do that third episode. But saying what you're saying, or going off what you're saying, I don't know that it's like bad. I feel like you were casting it in terms of like, oh, disaster, a word you used that was pretty negative. I think it's kind of inevitable, you know, it's like, and here's another thing. I guess it wouldn't be inevitable without the internet. Like, if we had just somehow been frozen in technology to where there were three channels forever, you know, like everybody watched the same three channels of television forever, I guess maybe it wouldn't. It's not inevitable in that sense. I think it's inevitable because of the democratization of making art. Like, it's so easy to make art now that was impossible 20 years ago. You know, like it's amazing. You know, art is still very hard. Don't get me wrong. Making good art is still really hard. But like the mechanical part of it. Like, if you want to record a song today, you know how hard that was like 30 years ago? Like, you know, 50 years ago, you have to get like a scientist and like they have like a technician in a white.
Someone's got to blow some glass tubes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even understand how it worked. Like, I literally think it was impossible that they recorded stuff like 100 years ago in divots on a disc. And then it somehow a needle, like that's magic. That didn't actually happen. I'm pretty convinced that's actually alien technology.
Well, Tesla was an alien, that's a fact.
Somehow it's easier for me to imagine just what I'm looking at now. I'm looking at the recording right now. Like, oh, that makes sense. Like, I talk into this microphone, it goes to my computer and whatever. But just a groove on like a, you know, on a...
Well, and I mean, even the computer part is magic to me. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's all magic. So there's some arrangement I'm very of much incredibly joking. Small.
It's amp. All magic.
It's just all magic. Yeah,
it's 100% magic. But still, like, vinyl was an amazing weird magic. I still don't understand.
I'm anyway, glad that we've solved the magic versus science debate. At least we've really settled that one.
I know. I hate to say it, but I'm firmly on the magic side. It's all magic. 100%. I mean, it really is indistinguishable from magic at this point. A lot of this stuff, as they say, like if you went back in time, you would seem like a wizard to certain people. Like, it all seems like wizardry to me, honestly, like a lot of this. And I'm like pretty mechanically minded, you know, like maybe a little above average and still just like incredible. But anyway, the point is that part's gotten really easy. And so there's going to be so much art. And what I was going to say is, I wonder if it will just decrease the sphere of possible, like, it will just decrease your target audience. You know, like, you used to, I imagine in the 50s and 60s, you know, you were trying, if you were like a doo-wop, you know, music group, you're trying to make a bubblegum single that the whole country will be like, oh yeah, I love that one. And you put it on the radio and everybody knows it. And now I just don't think you really can do that. Like, you can a little bit. There's still a bunch. I'm the worst at knowing what's popular.
But there's never going to be another Beatles.
No, there will never be another Beatles. Well, although those K-pop groups, I mean, maybe relative to where they have the greatest influence. But anyway.
It's different. I mean, it will be different. I think you're right
and
about that.
I don't know that it's better or worse. But I was the last thing I was going to say is, I think I welcome it because the alternative to me is something I can't stomach, which will get to my elitism, which I really want to get to next episode. I'm going to confess to being a horrible elitist, which everybody probably already knows. But it would mean, in order to maintain that society-wide frame of reference, that means I would have to like listen to, you know, popular music now, and I can't do that. So,
oh, I thought you were going to say that you were going to have to force everyone to listen to the things that you listen to. That was very differently than
happening.
I was expecting.
Are you kidding me? There's no chance that's happening. So, like,
I
would have
to
watch.
I thought we were all going to be going to Fleet Foxes concerts.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, that would be. No, I want to. He's already too popular for me. I want to be less popular. No, I would have to listen to whatever the heck the popular crap is now, and I just can't do it. It's too boring.
Infinity War is the musical?
Yeah, pretty much. But you know,
into existence, by the way. That didn't exist, and now Disney's in production. I just want you to know.
Yeah, right. I think they've learned their lesson after that Spider-Man thing. They're like, we just can't. It doesn't
I don't
work.
Know. Frozen's going great.
Is that Frozen? Would you really put that in the same category as Spider-Man the Musical?
I mean, in the sense that it ran a lot longer and was more successful.
But Frozen was a movie with songs. Like, sure, it already... Sure.
Oh, yeah, Spider-Man was a travesty. No question. We're so far off the map here.
Anyway, the point is, it's really interesting. I think I had one more interesting
Spider-Man's
thing to
objectively
say
wrong. Oh, there's an argument for me. I win. Checkmate,
I guess,
at the end.
No, okay. You win. I will make the side point that if the art you're making pretty much explodes and kills everybody, like, then... Yeah, that's objectively bad.
But Lord Killmonger really likes the art that explodes and kills everybody. So, subjective.
I was trying to throw you a bone, and then you took it and you spat it in my
face.
I know.
I'm really bad at taking bones.
Yeah, you looked a gift bone in the mouth. All right.
Oh, man.
Oh, so many references. Yeah, I think you successfully, or I successfully... just confused myself enough that I forgot the other good thing I was going to say, but that's good enough. It is interesting though. It is like entropy, you know, or like fractals or whatever. Like it just, there's so many references. You're going to have to make, oh, that's what I was going to say. It's already happening. You know, like I remember Donald Glover when he went on SNL, I don't really watch SNL much, but I'll watch, you know, if people say a skit is good, and he did his monologue, which was really funny. And he said, something like, oh, you probably all know me from Community, or if you're black, from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a funny joke. I hadn't seen Atlanta then. I've seen it now and I love it. But back then I was like, damn, he nailed me. Like, I've seen Community. I'm white and I haven't seen Atlanta. And then my wife and I eventually watched Atlanta. It's really good. Mm-hmm. But I think that does happen where you make art for a certain audience. And that's a very, you know, that's a literally black and white example, but I think there's further examples too. You know, you mm-hmm. make art for nerds, you make art for non-nerds, you make art for jocks, you know, that kind of
yeah.
thing. And I think it will continue and get more targeted. Yeah
I just want to say I think if you listen to Childish Gambino's raps, they actually dive really well into these questions of, like, you know, constructed identity and references and, like, who is he pitching himself to? What kind of thing is he selling? You know, a lot of musicians and artists do that, but he's very, very smart about sort of a very complex character that he has constructed within his rap world.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Donald Glover. I think he's great.
I think, again, rap is another world in which you see that, like, it benefits immensely from the increased cultural complexity. So, like, I agree with you that, like, it isn't necessarily a bad thing. It may just be a change. And this does, I mean, like, my intuition in all of this is more complex, more intricately referential art is better overall a lot of the time than the alternative. And we can maybe, you know, we can dive into that more in part three. But, like, I come down on the side that, like, you know, I grew up watching Marx Brothers and they're brilliant. But you go back and watch them and it's like,
oh,
you
it's
said,
awful.
Slow.
I know. I do
obvious.
The same thing with Inspector Clouseau and
mm-hmm.
Some of it's, you know, like here, there, you might still find something that's still funny, but sometimes it's like, oh, this is
and
painful.
Part of it, I think, is that the audience has improved in a sense
yeah.
that like the audience changed. Has a higher expectation, has a higher understanding.
I think we're bordering on what I want to talk about next week. So maybe we're already at
Great.
Time. So maybe
yeah.
we'll call it there and we'll leave that as kind of an entrance into next week's discussion. So why don't we do what we do? We already have previewed next week. We also need to do our patron shout out. So do they have anything good for you to say this week over on patreon.com/0G?
Yeah, special thanks as always to our top patrons. Now that I know I'm not a clone, I can have a normal identity crisis. Nice. It's getting really complex there. Making Andrew Shame laugh was the highlight of my week. A little bit of OA crossover. And if Picard isn't the best captain, then why is he the one coming back?
Nice.
That I think is it remains an unanswered gauntlet. If anyone wants to take to the Philosophers in Space Facebook group and fight that to the death, Klingon
style.
And I do want
to hear people's thoughts on objective, objective versus subjective as far as art goes.
Oh, I think we're gonna get some thoughts, buddy.
Yeah, and I've got more thoughts too. I'm excited. But let's head over to After Dark. Thanks so much to our top patrons. You definitely want to join their ranks. Come on. Make Aaron say some stuff. It's fun. It's, you know,
subjectively.
And I gotta say,
fun.
While I'm on this show, you know, I would rather these shout outs go to Aaron than Andrew. You know, while I'm on OA, I'm sure I'll make the opposing argument. But for right now, you know, like on this show, Yeah, come on. Target it toward, toward Aaron. Make him say something funny. All right.
Fair. It's totally fair. Objectively fair.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you all on After Dark.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
I've realized I just cannot read about why other people like anything. It's just, it's either, you know, and on one hand, it might be some people who you agree with and you're like, oh, okay, that person's a genius. Or somebody who watches it in a different way and you're like, well, they're a f-ing idiot. And like,
that's super
I'm not
funny.
Right, but it's, there's no, like, my, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying there's no good outcome. Like, there, it does nothing, you know, like.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.